The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Ryan Eldon Courtier, appellant. For the appellant, Mr. Courtier, we have Mr. Steve Callen and Mr. Aaron Solberg, attorneys from the Minnehaha County Public Defender's Office. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Stephen Blair, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Callen, I understand you'll be presenting today?
That's correct.
All right. All right, then, Mr. Collin, you have 20 minutes, and you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Judge.
Morning. Good to be back in Vermillion. I haven't been back. Actually, I think I made an oral argument like 20 years ago, and I can barely recall. I think I was scared to death, but I think I was here 20 years ago and did that.
Well, we're in a kinder, gentler mood today.
Oh, wonderful. That's good to hear. That was very good to hear.
We all have the memory, though, of being scared to death here.
Really, it's a pretty simple case, judges. I'm sure you're aware of that. Primary thing is, was there reasonable suspicion, or I guess we could say it more specifically, did Detective Walsh have reasonable suspicion, and we would also say as imputed through Officer Gardner, to make the stop of the van in which my client was riding. And of course, the court knows that after that van was stopped, turned out that Mr. Courtier had a suspended driver's license, and of course he was searched incident to the arrest, and we found it was suitable to control substance and meth found. That's really the main issue, and I think we'll probably talk about that primarily today. Although the sweeper issue, and I've got this variously written because I think I'm not sure if we agree necessarily on how we phrase it. I call it the kind of quirky and uncertain issue, but basically is After we just discussed the issue of reasonable suspicion and whether Detective Walsh had reasonable suspicion to stop the van, it's stopped by Officer Garden. The message that comes from Walsh to Garden is stop that van. And the reason that he calls for the law enforcement officers to stop the van is he thinks he's got reasonable suspicion based on what's been happening. We'll talk about that in a minute.
In view of some of the students arriving late, and they may not have had an opportunity to review the facts, could you give a short summary of the facts just for their benefit to start with?
Here's the good news on that, too. Really not much, probably not much disagreement on the facts, although there might be just a small one. Talking about the latter part of May of 2006, my client is in a red minivan, which happens to drive through a residence in Sioux Falls, and stops at about 8 o'clock in the evening. Still light outside.
Anything unusual about the area in Sioux Falls? Did that ever come out?
It didn't come out, Justice. It's a residential area. It's just off Sycamore. The court knows about Sioux Falls. In the eastern part of town, it's about like a half block off Sycamore, and it's a big apartment building. So there are like two big apartment buildings. And Mr. Guevara was apparently on the second floor of like the first apartment building. What happens, of course, is Navarro, who, of course, my client, I don't think anybody knows who Navarro is, or presumably doesn't know who he is, Navarro comes out and it talks with the van, which my client is riding in. And, of course, the facts are that Detective Walsh is on mobile surveillance. He's driving around because they've got a search warrant to go ahead and go into the Navarro apartment later on that evening. Anyway, so Walsh then is on mobile patrol. Walsh sees Navarro, the subject of the search warrant, come down and talk with somebody in the van. Walsh's testimony at suppression, he didn't see anything change hands. He didn't see anything suspicious. All he saw was that Navarro, the subject of the search warrant that they were going to execute in like the next hour or so, had come down and talked with somebody in the van. And I think the testimony was he thought somebody might have been outside the van. But here's the interesting thing also, too, I thought. He didn't have any notes of the stop and didn't actually have a report. So when he testified his impression, he was a little bit off of kind of his memory, and I think his memory was not fabulous. Real straightforward. Here's what happens then. The van leaves. The van comes back into the area an hour later. And Walsh saw the idling in front of the apartment building the first time around. Walsh doesn't see anything the second time around. Walsh is out of eyesight of the front of the apartment building. Walsh gets a communication from another surveillance officer who says that the van you saw earlier, and the reason this, I should have mentioned this earlier, The van that we're in is a van with Interlakes Community Action. I'm not sure if the court's familiar with that, but that's a community service organization out of Madison, 43 plates, Lake County plates. Walsh had noticed that the first time around, and so the second time around, the call from the surveillance guy is, hey, that same van you saw earlier just came into the area and is now leaving. Again, Walsh didn't see it, but he just got the call from surveillance. Walsh, at that point then, thinks he's got reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle because he calls ahead to Officer Garden to go ahead and stop the vehicle. So that basically is the reasonable suspicion thing. What we have is a vehicle driving through an area, having the subject of the search warrant come down, talk to that somebody in the van. No evidence whatsoever of any kind of exchanging of drugs or anything suspicious. And then the van coming back into the area a second time, and I've got it noted here, but the bottom line is Walsh testified at suppression and said that he did not know what happened to the van and whether it stopped the second time through, whether it pulled into the driveway, whether or not Mr. Navarro, the subject of the search warrant, came out to visit with the van. Had no information about what happened with the van the second time through, except that it had been through.
Sometimes the search warrants state that not only can the officers search the premises, the home or the house or building, but they can also search any vehicles that arrive at the building or near the building at the same time. Did this warrant have that kind of a provision?
I don't believe that did, Justice. And what it did do, of course, there were several vehicles that were owned by Navarro's girlfriend. And, of course, they're mentioned in the search warrant. So the law enforcement was authorized to go ahead and search those two vehicles. But I don't think that there's any authority, and I don't think there's any notation in the search warrant itself which would suggest that...
And there was no argument made below that that the search warrant covered this van?
No, it was not. As a matter of fact, it was stipulated that it didn't, so... And the other thing, of course, is just to add this. Law enforcement has been surveilling Mr. Navarro because he was a suspected drug dealer in Sioux Falls. They've been surveilling this guy, or actually investigating him. I guess the surveillance is the right word. They've been investigating Navarro for like 5 or 6 months. During that time, no mention of this van, or van with this license plate number, or any mention of any of my client, for instance, had come up during the investigation. So this was a totally unknown van that came through the area.
So how did the trial court err then?
How did it rule? How did it err?
How did it err? You're here because you think it erred. So tell us how it erred.
Well, the trial court thought that, and I think the actual language of the decision was, the interaction between Navarro and the members of the subject of the van or the van and the fact that the van came back a second time amounted to reasonable suspicion. That's the trial court's determination.
But the officer, he based that on the officer's testimony of why in his past and his knowledge of drug dealing that this happened often, that you had a car that would come through or a van that would come through and then go sell the drugs and come back, get some more. That's
right.
What he testified to.
Yep.
So isn't that what the trial court based it on?
I think they did, Justice. But here's the problem with that. Walsh testifies that in his experience, first off, of course, he'd been a drug detective for 3.5 years. We're not talking about somebody with 25 years experience. 3.5 years. He said in his experience, and here's the quote, I think, from the suppression: short-term traffic and repeat traffic at a certain home and making contact with a certain person suggests drug activity. Short-term traffic. Well, we're in the area once, and we're in the area an hour later. Short-term, maybe not. Repeat traffic, I guess same thing, but again, and also, I might note again, no testimony that on the second time through the van stopped. All we know is the van was in the area. Goes on at a certain home. Again, this is Walsh's thought as to what would be suspicious. At a certain home. Well, again, we don't know that the van came back to the home the second time. There was no testimony about that. And making contact with a certain person, guess what? We don't know, and again, there was never testimony at suppression hearing, that the second time through, Navarro came out and had contact with that van. We only know one contact. So what we have is one contact with the van, and then the van comes back. And we have nothing suspicious going on the first time around.
But what the way you're analyzing this is, it seems to me that you're taking each circumstance and you're saying, Now, each one of these has an innocent explanation, but that isn't the test, is it? I think the United States Supreme Court said you can't use this divide-and-conquer approach. What you have to do is you have to look at the totality of everything at the same time to see if it paints a picture of suspicion.
Like I remember Justice Sinter talking about that in the Kenyon case, and he talks about the divide-and-conquer. But here's the way this works, I think. If you have four or five facts that you're looking at that basically create reasonable suspicion, and if there are innocent explanations for like almost all of the facts, I guess my theory would be at that point then, based on the totality of the circumstances, you need to consider the innocent explanations. I agree with you. I don't think you go ahead and if you have, like for instance in Kenya, there were a whole bunch of facts that Doug McMurtry looked at. And of course the court said McMurtry should not have been looking at all those factors and should not have divided and conquered. And McMurtry was wrong in that case. But in this case, again, we don't have very many facts, Judge. And I think innocent explanations do play a part. Now, I wrote about innocent explanations a bunch in my brief, and the reason I did that was because Judge Severson, the trial court below, had talked really quite a bit about a couple of cases out of the Eighth Circuit, and really both of them talked a lot about innocent explanations, and so I thought maybe I'd better visit about it because I think Judge Severson was relying on those. But I think you're absolutely right. I think we really can't focus on innocent explanations, but if there seem to be explanations for almost everything that happened, somebody's driving by and a guy comes out to visit.
Isn't that part of the... It wasn't just a guy. It was the guy they had under surveillance for drug dealing.
True.
I mean, if it would have been anybody else, I think you wouldn't... He probably would have suppressed it.
Exactly. But I mean, from the standpoint of Detective Walsh, especially considering the fact that there was not a second stop, well, why wasn't it possible that that could have been some friend of Navarro's? So what happens here? So are we suggesting that anytime that you know somebody, any of us know somebody who's being investigated for drugs, if we happen to go ahead and have that person stop, you know, come out and visit with us in the car, we're driving by and they come out and they visit with us, and then we have to drive back to that area later on, we're subject to search, we're likely to be put on the ground by law enforcement because they think that there's reasonable suspicion to think that we're involved in drug activity? I mean, I think that's the argument on this case. That seems awfully strong to me.
Well, this is a reasonable suspicion case.
Exactly.
Not probable cause. True. Not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Pretty low standard.
Yep.
And all the officer has to do is articulate some reason that makes it suspicious to him. It shows it's not just whim or curiosity or hunch. Doesn't stopping twice, talking to the drug dealer once, and then the officer's testimony, that based on his experience, that is symbolic of drug trafficking. Isn't that exactly the kind of thing that the United States Supreme Court says if you have that, it's more than a hunch?
Okay, but I'll correct you. I think just on one. There's not a second stop, Judge. We don't know about a second stop. All we know about is one stop, and then we know that the van drove through the area. That's all we have. I would agree with you totally. If we have a second stop, I think if law enforcement sees that van stop a second time, wait a second, what's this about? You know, we were out here idling the first time around, now we're stopping the second time. If we see Navarro come out and talk with the van the second time around, we got a problem. You know, I think there's certainly reasonable suspicion to stop. If we see suspicious things going on, if we see, you know, if we've seen anything, again, Walter, he saw nothing changing hands when he drove by the first time around. If we'd seen anything, I think we have reasonable suspicion. Seems to me that what we've got now, we need to have one or two, at least one more thing to rise to reasonable suspicion. That's my argument, certainly.
Is there any significance to the fact that this vehicle is from a community action program from a county outside of Minnehaha? I mean, wouldn't it make you wonder, why is this thing in the neighborhood? What's it doing here?
Of course, actually, I think I would say it's probably an innocent fact. You know, if you're looking for people who are probably involved in drug activity, and you run up the license plate number and it comes back registered to Interlakes Community Action, I think if I'm a law enforcement officer, I'd say this doesn't look like a very likely drug vehicle to me. So I think it kind of cuts that way. Now, the second issue, of course, we want to go on to that. The second issue, of course, is sort of this interesting one where, for some unknown reason, Walsh, of course, radios ahead, or actually doesn't radio ahead, because it's actually, Walsh is actually at a location with these other patrol officers. This actually comes out in suppression. He's actually parked right with the patrol officers. When he hears about the second coming, he basically tells these guys, go stop that van. And of course, we're talking now about Officer Jeff Gardner, we're talking about Mateo, but primarily Gardner. Gardner, for some unknown reason, interprets this message to be that the subject of the van was in the car, the subject of the search warrant was in the van. So if he gets it wrong, State Court makes the argument that this is really not a communication problem, that somehow this is, you know, some kind of a judgment or some kind of a conclusion that Gardner had come up with. But the argument then becomes, and Judge Stevenson, you know, went along with this, that if Gardner had some sort of a reasonable belief, presumably, that the subject of the van, subject search warrant of the van, that he would then have some sort of individualized right to make the stop. And he cites the Mueller case for that, and I'm sure the court's familiar with the Mueller case. The Mueller case would not suggest that at all, I don't think. First off, the Mueller case has to do with communications. It has to do with communications that come out of here. We got the law, I think this is the law enforcement officer, I think this is the guy who's from Watertown. Anyway, bottom line is, the law enforcement officer thinks that the license plate has been expired, but the registration has not been updated, stops this vehicle in the Mueller case. And of course, the issue is whether or not the stop was illegitimate based on the fact that the information he was getting from Pierre was wrong. The Mueller case says that if the law enforcement officers are relying on erroneous information from a different source, from a different agency, in this case out of Pierre, that they're justified in relying on the information. If, however, it's the fellow officer type situation where we're receiving information from another officer, Mueller case doesn't mean that it's a legitimate stop because you're relying on that information. It would actually cut the other way. I mean, I think the case law certainly is that if you get invalid information, incorrect information from a fellow officer and make a stop in pursuance of that information, that's an invalid stop. I think that's Mueller. I think that's Whiteley versus Warden. I think that's that line of cases. That's the fellow officer cases. Any more questions? I think that's where we're at.
You didn't file a reply brief. Do you think the state offered nothing that you shouldn't defend?
Well, they didn't offer much. For instance, on the whole issue of Gardner being able to go ahead and somehow save the stop because of some kind of miscommunication, the state really has no authority in their brief at all for that proposition. I think they cite the Engesser case, but the Engesser case wouldn't stand for that. So, with the possible exception of if there's an argument about whether or not there were two stops, and I think that's real debatable too. I'm not sure that, first off, Judge Severson didn't rely on that, but that would be the only reason that I would have needed a reply brief. I read the state's brief over and I thought there's no authority on the second issue. The first issue I think has been pretty well presented to the court as far as what reasonable suspicion and what the arguments are, pro and con, so I didn't file one. Besides, I'm busy.
Okay. You complete your presentation?
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Blair, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please, the court. Counsel. I would agree with Mr. Cowan that the case is pretty straightforward, and while we don't disagree on much, I think what we do disagree on is the exact points that the case is decided on. Judge Severson found that reasonable suspicion existed in this case based on the historical facts and Detective Walsh's application of his rational inferences to those facts. And the state's position is that that was the correct determination, and moreover, that is exactly what we asked law enforcement in South Dakota to do.
What about the fact that the van didn't, we don't know if it stopped the second time or if it was just driving down the street?
I think arguably, if you read the transcript, you can infer from Walsh's testimony that there was a second stop. I don't think it's concrete, exactly clear. Yes, I was told there was a second stop, but I believe Detective Walsh speaks of the van either pulled into the driveway or pulled into the street, and I think Judge Severson interpreted that as a second stop. I would submit that whether the van actually came to a stop and was put in park doesn't really decide the case. I think when you look at the totality of the historical facts that Detective Walsh had in front of him and the inferences that he was able to draw based on his training and experience, that reasonable suspicion existed.
Well, it's more consistent with innocent behavior the second time around if he's just driving down the street rather than stopping.
I would agree. If you look at that fact alone, it's akin to innocent behavior, but as you discussed with Mr. Cowan, that's not the test. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that you cannot look at these one factor at a time, and if you have five factors, say, well, factor one is innocent, so plus mark, factor two is suspicious, so negative, and in the end come up with, you know, three pluses and two negatives, so no reasonable suspicion. That's not the standard. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances together through the eyes of a law enforcement officer based and take into account his training and experiences and the inferences that allows him to make and determine whether the suspicion he developed was reasonable.
I'm having a hard time understanding, though, what drug activity was that he suspect was taking place. No one ever saw anything exchange hands. It was just two people talking. How does that constitute suspicion of drug activity?
I think Detective Walsh testified that in his training experience, short-term traffic and repeat traffic at a known drug location oftentimes indicates that person that's engaged in the traffic is also involved in the distribution of drugs. He had the set of facts in front of him, and that's the inference he drew from his training and experience, that I'm at a known drug location. I know that this Mr. Navarro is a multiple pound distributor of methamphetamine in the Sioux Falls area. We've had this under surveillance. We've investigated him for 5 or 6 months. This van pulls up. Mr. Navarro comes out and talks to him. Okay, now I have contact between the known drug distributor and the people in the van. The van pulls away. Detective Walsh didn't order the stop then. To his credit, he withheld, and the van comes back. And at that point, you know, his training and experience kicks in, and he says, we now have repeat short-term traffic in this area. I have a connection between these people and the drug distributor. I feel I have reasonable suspicion to stop them. I think starting with Terry and the line of cases that have followed, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that is exactly what we want law enforcement officers to do. Terry struck a very delicate balance between constitutional rights and effective police work. And part of effective police work means that they are allowed to stop individuals in these cases to see if their suspicion, which is reasonable, is correct or not.
Isn't it more of a hunch, though? Because he doesn't see anything transpire.
I would disagree. It's not a hunch. I think when you look at the
fatality. But he admits he didn't see him. I mean, there was no package or anything that Navarro had. All he was doing was talking to this guy.
That's true. I don't think that an exchange of a package or money is necessary to find reasonable suspicion. I'm nervous of the court going down that path because I think then you create in drug situations.
I don't know that we would say that, but you still have to look at all the circumstances. And I mean as Justice Konenkamp said, what would have raised the suspicion?
I think all of the circumstances together is what raised the suspicion. Detective Walsh observed all these and heard these other facts from the other officer and then put them together and applied his training and experience to them to develop the suspicion. This court, I think, has found reasonable suspicion on much less. I believe in the Herbolt case, Herbolt, reasonable suspicion was based on a car horn honk that then allowed officers to follow that individual to his home, and once there they discovered that he was driving while intoxicated. I would submit that that's much less reasonable suspicion than we have here. Again, I think that, you know, Detective Walsh, if he had stopped the van the first time it was in the area, I would agree that that was not reasonable suspicion. The fact that the van came back and we have a connection to the drug distributor is what is the tipping point. And I would say, Mr. Cowan argues that it wasn't a stop and maybe it was just a roll through, and that means there wasn't. Even if it was just a roll through, I think that it allows Detective Walsh to come to that decision.
There wasn't anything in particular about the van that he articulated made him suspicious.
I don't believe he testified that there was. He did testify.
He just remembered it because it was a red van with a
he testified,
logo on it.
You're correct, Justice Meyer. He testified he remembered the van based on who the license plate was registered to. We can speculate as to whether, since it's a social services agency van, does that mean, well, maybe it shouldn't have been in the area or it should have been?
He doesn't articulate any of that.
He doesn't say anything like that. I think it's clear when you look at the record that Detective Walsh had reasonable suspicion to stop this van. And under the collective knowledge doctrine, that reasonable suspicion was imputed to Officer Garden. Therefore, Garden had reasonable suspicion to stop the van. I don't think, once the court determines that, I don't think it has to go any further. There's no quantum of information that Detective Walsh has to give Officer Garden in order to stop the van. When you look at these situations, it's the knowledge of all the officers together that the court looks at. Detective Walsh didn't have to say, you need to stop this van because I have reasonable suspicion based on these facts and this inference. All he has to say is, I think we have reasonable suspicion to stop the van. Or just, you know, I want you to stop the van. The only way to reach the second issue is if you determine that Detective Walsh did not have reasonable suspicion at all. And I guess I will admit that my brief on that issue is kind of muddled. I'm not happy with it at all in reviewing it for arguments. I apologize to the court. I don't know if when I was writing it, I didn't have it clear in my own head what I was trying to say, but it's not my best work. And again, I apologize. What I was trying to say is that Officer Garden, it was not erroneous information that was passed to Officer Garden. Correct information that Officer Garden then developed an erroneous understanding of. I think based on that, Mueller is distinguishable. Mueller talks about erroneous information being passed from one officer to another, and that's not the case here.
What is the test here then? Some kind of a good faith? Or what is it?
I believe that's what I was getting at, and I believe that is what Judge Severson was driving at, although he wasn't very clear either.
So his decision was really based on the reasonable, articulable suspicion that the officers had.
I believe that's correct. He applied, I think, a good faith analysis to Officer Garden's actions. That Officer Garden developed this understanding based on the radio communication, that he had a good faith belief in that, and what his understanding was, and that belief gave him reasonable suspicion to stop the van. Now, it turned out afterwards that Officer Garden's belief was not correct.
I want to go back to the reasonable suspicion now. The officer says that, in his experience, this pattern is evidence of drug activity. Is that something that we have to take as gospel from him? Or is there some other source that we can look at, an objective source that we can look at to say, well, you know, is this or is this not really a pattern of drug activity that creates reasonable suspicion?
I don't think you have to take it as gospel, but it is a significant factor to look at in the entire analysis.
It's his opinion, but, I mean, you don't give us any cases where other officers have used that same information to form this, to form that same opinion. I mean, where does that... We're not law enforcement officers, so we can't contradict him. So what source do we go to say, well, you know, otherwise we're simply at the mercy of whatever the officer's opinion is. Where do we go to find out what is a reasonably objective pattern of drug activity that justifies stopping someone?
The short answer is I don't know. I don't know what source you would turn to. Other than, as you suggest, in case in a future sighting, similar cases where this pattern has been found to equal reasonable suspicion.
Would this be the kind of a case maybe where you'd call an expert, you know, and say, well, you'd bring an expert in to say, because when we can stand to be educated, we get educated about all kinds of facts, you know, all kinds of things in science, and in law enforcement techniques, maybe this is an area that an expert would have been helpful.
I understand the desire to have an expert. I think that would basically eviscerate the reasonable suspicion standard. It's set low for a reason. And I think when you start requiring experts at suppression hearings, you suddenly raise the standard to a bar higher than what the Supreme Court has set.
You may be right, but I'm thinking of cases like methamphetamine. You know, I don't know how methamphetamine, I didn't know how it was made. But after hearing a lot of cases and hearing people testify how methamphetamine is made, then we hear an officer say, well, I saw, you know, certain evidence of methamphetamine. Well, okay, now I understand why the officer was suspicious, because he smelled something, he saw certain ingredients. You know, there are certain things that show that there's a methamphetamine lab. But, you know, where do we get the information for this kind of a... this kind of a hunch, well, not a hunch, but I mean this kind of a pattern?
I think while review is de novo on these situations, I think to a great extent it would be the findings and conclusions of the trial court.
So how much deference do we need to give to that?
The review is de novo on reasonable suspicion. However, the findings of fact are reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. And once those, if you find that those findings are not clearly erroneous, then you apply them de novo to the state of the law. I don't think there's an argument made that the findings of Judge Severson were erroneous. And for the life of me right now, I can't remember if he made a specific finding about the reasonableness of Detective Walsh's inference. But I would submit that you could look for some support in those findings and conclusions if the trial judge chose to make them.
Did the court explain why it thought this pattern was evidence of drug activity? I mean, what does this pattern show? I mean, it's conclusory to say it shows drug activity. Well, that doesn't really, that just spins us in a circle. What is the pattern that drug people purveying in drugs, why is that an indication that they're dealing in drugs?
Judge Severson ruled that based on the connection that was established between the occupants of the van and Navarro and the short-term repeat traffic in the area, and Judge Severson did look at both the Eighth Circuit cases, Crawford and Buchanan, he found that that connection between the known drug distributor and the occupants of the van, along with the short-term traffic in the area, equaled reasonable suspicion. That is what he ruled, and he relied on Crawford and Buchanan for that.
So he did it without finding a second stop. He relied on short-term traffic in the area.
I believe Judge Severson viewed it as a second stop.
And what do you base that on?
I believe Detective Walsh's testimony as to... I don't remember specifically the finding or the conclusion that states this. I don't think he went into specifics as to what he was basing his conclusion of a second stop on. And I'm guessing he based it on Detective Walsh's testimony. It either pulled up in the driveway or pulled into the street and then left. I think that is how he came to the conclusion there was a second stop. And in reading that portion, I can see how Mr. Cowan interprets it, but I also can see how Judge Searson interprets it. I think Judge Severson interpreted it correctly. I guess just to, I have, if there's no more questions, I'll just summarize. The state feels that the historical facts that Detective Walsh knew, supported by his rational inferences based on his training experience, rose to a level of reasonable suspicion. The low bar, it's even less than a preponderance of the evidence. Once that was established, that was imputed to Officer Garden under the collective knowledge rule. Officer Garden then had the right to stop that van, and anything that transpired afterwards is admissible. If the court should find that there was no reasonable suspicion on behalf of Detective Walsh, I do believe that there was an objective, good faith belief on behalf of Garden that he interpreted the radio communication correctly and then therefore believed he had a basis to make the stop.
You've revised several times or made reference to the extensive experience that Officer Walsh had. Would it make a difference if he was just newly assigned to the drug detail and was coming on the scene for the first time and had no extensive experience?
I think that's a factor to look at. And I think it's up to the trial judge below and this court to weigh that in their decision. I would submit that 3 years of experience in narcotics investigation is more than enough to know that short-term repeat traffic in a known drug distribution area usually means that that person may be also involved in drug distribution. If he was newly on the force, just went through law enforcement training class, that would be something to look at. And in the future, it may very well be a tipping factor whether there's reasonable suspicion or not. In this case, I think the 3 years of experience is more than enough.
What do you say Walsh's testimony was? Because I don't recall him witnessing the second stop. So what do you claim his testimony was as to whether or not there was a stop?
He was told, over the radio that the van had come back. They had run the plate again, and he said, "Yes, I remember that plate from before." And I believe his testimony was that I think you can infer that he was told, and he doesn't quite remember because, again, he didn't have notes or a report, the van either pulled up in the driveway or pulled into the street, and that was the knowledge that was given to him over the radio.
So he's inferring that, and we don't have the basis of what was said to cause that inference?
We don't have the exact communication between him and the other officer.
Okay. Thank you.
And he didn't do a report.
He did a report. The report, it's my understanding, was entered in the file in Mr. Navarro's case and not in this one.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Blair. Mr. Cowan, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Well, I know we're all interested in what Officer Walsh said at the suppression hearing about what he'd seen or what he knew. Here I'm looking at page number 17 of the suppression hearing toward the bottom, and I think the answer is pretty clear as to what we know. Question: what information did you have about the second stop of the van? Answer from Walsh: I don't remember exactly. It either pulled into the driveway or pulled into the street. I don't recall if anybody or if anybody got out or if anyone came out of the apartment building. The only thing that I recall for sure is that the second surveillance called up the license plate, and I said, "Hey, that's been here before. That's been here earlier." And as for specific details, I don't remember exactly what was said. And then, just for our interest, there are two other references to this, also in the suppression hearing. Bottom of page 7 basically just says, "I saw the van once," and the other surveillance members saw it the second time, which I guess doesn't add too much. And then page 6 of the suppression, it's just they're talking about just things in general. Did he come out of the apartment building and come to the van? Of course, this is talking about the first time. Answer, yes, sir. The one time that I saw, he came out of the apartment building, and one of the other surveillance officers saw him the second time. I was out of position to see the front at that time. So bottom line, Walsh didn't know about the movements of the van the second time around. Now, it's interesting Judge Severson, we can make the argument, I think, that we do have clearly erroneous, maybe a clearly erroneous finding of fact at 5 and maybe conclusion of law at 1, but it might be beside the point because I don't think Judge Severson relied on a second stop when he made his decision. You know, again, his decision was that the interaction of Navarro and the people in the van first time through, and the fact that it came back into the, in fact, the word was locale later on, to, in Judge Severson's mind, rose to reasonable suspicion. And again, that's where all, we're talking about that, of course, today, and that's the issue. I had a few more thoughts on reasonable suspicion while I was sitting there. They've been surveilling Navarro for 5 or 6 months, or not surveilling, but investigating him. Was there any evidence, or no evidence certainly came out at hearing and would have been useful about whether or not Navarro, does he deal out of his apartment building? I guess if we knew that, that would have been something worthwhile knowing, but we don't know the answer to that. So did he habitually walk out into the street with drugs and say,
was the search warrant part of the evidence that was submitted at the suppression hearing?
Actually, it was not. No.
So if that said whatever it would have said, we don't have any idea.
Right, and that, yeah.
In this case, because exactly. It's not been presented by the state.
Just to follow up Mr. Blair for a second, I think the real situation, Walsh said that he didn't have a report. I don't think Walsh actually had a report on this. I think the Navarro case was a federal case. I think obviously Walsh had a report about, you know, we were surveilling, we had a search warrant, we went and we found all this stuff. But I don't think that Walsh ever made, my understanding was he never had a report about this incident at all. Didn't go in the federal file, didn't go to our file. So I think that's where that is.
So you're saying they investigated him for 6 months and they never found anything and they got frustrated and jumped the gun?
I don't know the answer to that, Judge. I don't know. I guess just from what I hear, I heard Navarro, I think, was a pretty big operator in Sioux Falls. And I suppose they were, you know, on the scroll, they were probably watching him to see who all he knew and let's take notes, let's round people up later on or something. So I don't know that they didn't think they had the information. They probably did, actually. The fact is there was no reason to connect my guy or the van to any kind of drug activities. He drove by and or stopped the first time and then just drove by the second. The other thing, here's the other thought that I have. What are we talking about? We're talking about May 31st of 2006. Now, I haven't looked back at the record, but I bet it was a pretty nice day. And it's 8 o'clock in the evening. We don't know what Navarro, again, to kind of go back to my first thing, we don't know what Navarro's, you know, we don't know what his modus operandi was. But I wonder if his modus operandi, especially if he's a multi-pound meth dealer, would involve walking out into the middle of the street. The car is idling, the van is idling in the middle of the street in front of this apartment building. There are apartment buildings around. We're talking a residential area. There are folks around. We're not talking about somebody, some drug deal being made at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, in some back alley. I just wonder whether or not Navarro comes out and makes a deal at 8 o'clock in the evening with somebody who stops in front of his house for all the world to see. I mean, including
Walsh. Did you share those wonderings with Judge Severson?
Excuse me?
Did you share those wonderings with Judge Severson?
I'm not sure if I shared that wondering with him, actually. He had his own wonderings.
If so, he wasn't impressed, huh?
He wasn't. I don't think he was.
You did submit briefs, though, it looks like, because he quotes from your brief, or from the state's brief in his opinion.
Yeah. I think that pretty much kind of exhausts the whole question about reasonable suspicion, unless the court has some other questions. Then we get into it. I don't know how much we want to get into it, because, again, Mr. Blair was very honest and said that you didn't really have much authority on the second argument. I think I ran across something. You probably could just... Where is it here? But what we're talking about here is possibly relying on some kind of a subjective belief. And I guess the question would be, I'm thinking the court's maybe not going to get here anyway, but I guess what kind of slippery slope are we talking about here? If we're talking about Garden had this subjective belief, and I suspect what's going on here, he basically has been posted, and his job is to go ahead and stop any vehicles that are leaving the location where they're going to execute the search warrant. So and I'm just hypothesizing, theorizing here. My guess would be that when the news came to him, stop that van, maybe he just sort of jumped to the conclusion and thought, well, that must mean that the subject of the search warrant must be in the van. Maybe that was just his own, what was that, his own calculation or his own determination about what was going on. But if we would allow, if the court would allow the stop based on that sort of subjective thought, I was doing a little research just looking at this, and again, this is the Beck versus Ohio case, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, and it refers to probable cause, of course, not reasonable suspicion, but I think it's probably appropriate anyway. This is the case of the related probable cause, and the court says, if subjective good faith alone were the test, the protections of the Fourth Amendment would evaporate, and the people would be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects only to the discretion of the police. So I think that's where we go if we do that. If we decide that what he thought was going on, as opposed to what the objective facts that Walsh is able to bring to us, and that the state's able to bring to us to go ahead and explain why they stopped that vehicle, we rely on the subjective thought of the officer, and we have problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carolyn.